Diversity.
Here you have caused confusion. I will trash his board.
Well, hello everyone. Hopefully you can hear me after the debacle of Tuesday where we tried to do the annual Christmas stream and it didn't work. Press one if you can hear me. If you can't, the stream is cancelled. Can you hear me? Just tell me if you can hear me already. Press one. Oh, you're feeling in one of those sorts of moods where you're not going to... Okay, all right, there's all the ones. Excellent, excellent. So, this changes everything. It was like all of the Christmases came at once for every news channel, for every organization from Daily Wire to Judge Knapp to all the rest of them. Real game changer. There is nothing that the algo, that the slot merchants, that the slot munchers love more than the notion of the single game-changing move that changes all other things. One of the interesting things you might do is to pick your favorite channel, whether it's Russell Brand or Ben Shapiro, or Jordan Peterson, or Tim Pool, or Steve Turley, or Judge Napolitano, or even some of the more sophisticated channels like the Duran, and go back through their back catalog. Scroll back maybe like 3 or 4 years, and then slowly scroll up across the hundreds and hundreds of videos that they produce on a weekly, daily basis, and count the number of times where it's a happening. It's happening, everyone. It's really happening this time. And I think this Syria situation, which I did the video on this morning, and I gave my kind of serious assessment on in the video this morning, is almost like an ideal test case, because it is quite a big world event. A regime that has been there for 5 decades plus has been replaced with a bunch of nominally jihadis that have been funded by, depending on who, which group you're looking at, the CIA, Turkey, and some of them Pentagon. This is one of the most confusing aspects of it. I didn't mention it in the video. A little bit too much complexity for my video this morning is the fact that there are there are actually CIA-backed jihadis and Pentagon-backed jihadis that are at odds in Syria. I think, I can't remember which way around it is. I think the Pentagon have backed the ones who are down in the south, and the CIA backed the Kurds in the northeast. But don't quote me on that. I could have it the wrong way around. On the face of it, it's quite a big happening. It does seem to, quote unquote, change everything. But another way of looking at it is basically nothing's changed. Basically, we're in the same old holding pattern. But, you know, basically the escalation that is promised between Iran and Israel never really happens. Basically, the deadlock between in the new Cold War is still not really broken. Okay. Yes, it is a blow to Russia and Iran, as I mentioned in the video, and it is a boon for the Western powers in the general great game, if you want. But really, nothing. It's not the the one move that's going to change everything or necessarily change the outcome. And I'm fascinated by why it is that the algo, because I mean, the algo is basically code for what is it that people want to see, right? Why is it that people have this bias towards the one great game changing move or event? They love it. Everybody loves it. And I would say every side is kind of guilty of it as well. I remember a couple of weeks back, the Judge Napolitano crew, that was Mia Shimer, Ray McGovern, Alistair Crook, Larry Johnson, who else is part of that crew? Scott Ritter, Douglas McGregor. They were all saying this Oreshnik missile, the Oreshnik missile, it's a game changer. It's a game changer. But it didn't change a game, did it? Now, Assad has fallen. And again, it's a game changer. It's a game changer. But did it really change the game, though? And this is the all difficult might of Baudrillard, and nothing ever happens. Do you remember when we covered Baudrillard and when I gave my talk at the WITAM earlier this year? I said a nuclear bomb could drop, and if the net result is Candice Owens and Piers Morgan shouting at each other on YouTube the next day, even if a nuclear bomb has dropped, nothing's really happened. Was the net outcome of Assad falling basically Piers Morgan and Candice Owens shouting at each other? Yes, it was. And this is one of those rather difficult things in the modern world, right? In the postmodern moment, where even events of seemingly world-altering significance basically within the space of a few days get reduced down to the level of Piers Morgan just talking, or Candice Owens just talking, or even me just talking. It's never really the game changer. I don't know what to do about that. I mean, this is part and parcel of what Baudrillard was talking about. It's like, well, you know, the Gulf War did not take place. You know, well, Assad fell. But from the point of view of all of us, did he, like, what difference does it make? You know, it's a very strange thing. It's kind of real, but it's also hyper real. And in the hyper reality, all it really is a set of talking points for the Tory boys, right? As far as you or I experience it in life, all it is a set of talking points. It's Easter Gammon worshiper and Vanishing Point fist pumping at their screens. Get in. It's like, you know, you imagine Easter Gammon worshiper and Vanishing Point, you know, high-fiving each other as they watch their wives getting railed, basically. That's basically the energy that I've seen over this online. It's just like, oh, you know, one side gets to cheer now, and the other side gets to. And I've seen like lots of other things on this. I saw Keith Woods put a video out on it, and like he was somber and he was grave and he was almost kind of like feeling a little bit hurt that. You know, the axis of resistance had taken this like real body blow here. And, you know, he has started to say things like, well, the axis of resistance is a bit of a cope, really. Does it really exist? And I do think that a large element of the narratives and the counter narratives, whether they're on the NATO or the NAFO side, or on the, or indeed on the Judge Knapp side, or on the Russian side, the Duran side, whichever way you want, there's a huge amount of hyper-reality that goes round, where these events that are happening far off, that have nothing to do with most people, become a kind of vicarious game where you feel high or you feel low. and I don't know what to do about that. Is it just sophisticated, like football for politico nerds? That's my question. This changes everything. Is it just football for politics nerds? That's my question. So anyway, let's, yeah, I mean, how do people feel about that? Is it real? Or is it, I mean, as far as we experience it in Britain, for example, or in Europe or in America, is this real? Or is this another, indeed the most hyper version of the hyper reality? You know, I've talked about before, I put out shorts saying, like, concentrate on what you can control, not on what you can't control. Well, I mean, the thing that we have least control over is foreign policy. Foreign policy, not only of America, but of, you know, of other countries, of Russia and Turkey and Iran, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, we fucking love it, don't we? Geopol, that's the bit we really, it's, that's the most like chess, or the most like the board, the strategic board games that I play, or the most like some of the strategic video games that we play. Is that why we like it? Because it's the most strategic part. It's where we can look at maps, look at the pipes, think about the plays. Everybody's a Machiavellian. It's like the Game of Thrones, but Game of Thrones for men and in the real world. I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't know what the answer is. But I run a politics channel. And I fucking love it. I've got to be honest. I love it. And these are sorts of events, you know, a dictator falls. You get to see, you know, the reality behind the facade of the regime. New group comes in, counter elite, elite. Oh, I fucking love it. Gets me going. I get to study the yet another regime that's fallen. What's gone right? What's gone wrong? This is the stuff. It's real. It's raw. It's friend and enemy. We love it, don't we, folks? I mean, it's kind of got nothing to do with, you know, my actual real life has been like going to buy a Christmas tree, getting a little bit obsessed with rogue-like deck builder games, which I'll tell you about in a second. You know, it's pretty mundane, to be honest. Taking stuff down the garage earlier on, trying to make sure I got an essay in for some magazine that I promised to give an essay for, you know, talking to some book publishers, mundane stuff, right? But the fall of Assad, it's like my favorite TV show just like hit its finale. Don't know what else to say, really. Now, I should say that the buying of the Christmas tree was one of the all-time best situations. I was in one of those no-nonsense, don't-give-a-shit sort of moods yesterday. Mrs. AA, she's a bit of a perfectionist. She likes to fuss. She likes to, you know, examine every branch. Is it the right shape? All this sort of stuff. At times in the past, she spent hours to pick a Christmas tree. Well, little AAA, she wanted to buy the Christmas tree from this little greengrocer that's down in town. Lovely little old-fashioned greengrocer. The guy there, very typical Cockney, fat, must have been about 30 stone. He was on the phone. He was having one of the most stereotypical Cockney conversations I can ever remember. He was like, hey, hello, it's me, the greengrocer. Remember the guy who really likes black pudding? He was on the phone to somebody. So I couldn't really get hold of him. So I had to get hold of his little assistant. And I swaggered in. I said, I'd like to buy a Christmas tree, please. So you got any idea of which one? I said, that one there. I said, how much is it? He said, £40. I said, done, wrap it. Mrs. A couldn't believe it. 3 minutes we were. Done and dusted. Bob's your uncle. No fuss whatsoever. That is how a man buys a Christmas tree. And little AAA was over the moon because we got it from the greengrocer, which is what she wanted, not from the garden center or the other place up the road.
All right.
No offense to any Cockneys or greengrocers. I'm not suggesting you're all 30 stone. I'm just saying that one so happened to be a pretty large fellow. And he had like the apron with his gut over the apron, you know, and he, I don't know. He just, to me, he looked like a character from a video game or something. Be like, oh, you know, when you speak to the trader or the blacksmith or something, there's always some fat, bald dude. He looked exactly like that. Okay. Anyway. where are we? Okay. Yes. Let us take a look now at some of the Q&As that have come in over the past week. I'm sure some of them will be about the Syria situation, which I'll talk more about. I should mention, I played this game called Inscription a couple of weeks back, and it's kind of a very strange game. Don't read about it. If you haven't played it, you should just play it blind. Really interesting game. And it's one of these roguelike deck builders, which is a genre I quite like. If you played Slay the Spire back in the day. But anyway, I started playing this, and then typically I got busy, so it broke my thing. But then I just went wild and bought every single rogue, all of like the top-rated rogue-like deck builders. And I've just become obsessed with them now. Balatro, the poker one. I mean, the game is too good to play, folks. I lost like a day just playing Balatro. There's a game called Luck Be a Landlord, which is kind of similar vibe to Balatro. Also worth a look. Slice and Dice, worth a look. Knock on the Coffin Lid, worth a look, friends. Across the Obelisk, that was one I played last year or 2 years ago. I pumped quite a few hours into that one, but it's worth a look. Monster Train, it's worth a look. If you'd like a video on this, let me know and I'll make one, gladly. All right, so let me have a look then at the Super Thanks. This is quick. It's the Goblin Raid. Goblin Raid! this is only going to be a short stream because I've got the school runner as well. I'm just slipping it in, basically. The missus has gone shopping. So let's see where we can start. For the Deepest Lore Christmas stream, me and Farrah are going to try to reconvene next week. Something went wrong with StreamYard, basically. So, all right. Where was the last... Is this it? I think it's here from Fringemin Church. Re Adam Curtis's The Trap. Could you try to explain the idea articulated by the guy Michael Ledeen that America would be better off and more secure if the world was primarily populated by democratic countries? To the degree it was not about fighting communism, is the idea just diffusing the executive agency from foreign leaders, making foreign policies influenceable, corruptible by non-direct and non-violent means like CIA or NGOs? These things, I think, are true. But do you think that's what they had in mind? They never seem to explain it. Step one, spread democracy. Step three, America is safe. Well, there's two real reasons behind this idea, I think. The first is very simply friend and enemy. You want a regime that is friendly to America, first and foremost, okay? So, I mean, let's face it, the neocons don't really care that the House of Saud is not a democracy. What they care about is whether the House of Saud does things that are favorable to Israel and to America. That's their number one concern. They didn't really care if Chile was a democracy or run by General Pinochet. Okay. So democracy is just regime talk half the time for friend. Okay. Don't forget, in their purview, Viktor Orban is not really a democracy, even though he was democratically elected, right? Putin was democratically elected, but that doesn't really matter because in their purview, he is an enemy, so therefore not democracy. So democracy just means friend. On a more practical level, I think that they think that the managerial apparatus works best, right, with democracy. If you think about the typical strongman dictatorship regime, the total number of people that are influenceable is quite small. So the nodes of corruption are the keys, if you want to, who have to be paid off, are quite small. Now, on the one hand, you might think, well, that would make that makes the a strongman dictatorship quite fragile because, you know, as we saw with Assad, well, get to those keys and they're pretty easy to pay off and that's the end of the regime. Well, that's true. But most of those dictatorships in history don't really get to the point that Assad got to. They usually are pretty good at paying off those keys. So once they're dug in, it's pretty hard to get them dug out again. So that's one reason why they may prefer having the massive bureaucratic apparatus that a democracy requires, okay? And the more democratic, quote-unquote, bodies you have, the greater the number of attached parasites there are to that body. Think about the different branches of the EU. Each one of them then spawns a new set of managerial parasites, okay? Or think in the UK, the Welsh Assembly and the Scottish Parliament, new sets of managerial parasites buried into the system who then, if you wanted to, if somebody hostile to America, say, wanted to take that place over, well, there's a whole range of middling bureaucrats and managers that now need to be paid off that are dug in there, right? So that is, I think, a practical reason why they prefer democracy to the dictatorship setup, because it's easier for them to infiltrate and control and gain managerial oversight over. Okay, so that's there. It's desirable for them to have that, but it's not necessary. The necessary thing is being friendly to America. But the desirable thing is to have a democratic regime with attached NGOs and bureaucratic parasites that they can then use to change the body politic. Very good book on this is the one I've recommended a number of times by the French economist. I forget the name now. What's it called? It's a book about how America did this to all of Europe after World War II. They're using the Marshall Plan. They didn't just give aid or loans under the Marshall Plan. They were like, right, here's a bunch of stuff, but one of our caveats is you have to have a set of experts and advisors who come in, right? American ones, American ideologists, Chicago school guys, whoever, right? Those guys come in, and then they set about changing all of the corporate structures to align with the American way of doing things, not the European way of doing things. That's been American strategy. So they change it such a place from the inside out. And if you have a democracy, it's easier to bring all of this stuff in under the hood with it looking fairly kind of official and above board. If you have a dictatorial regime, they have a much stronger sense of friend and enemy. Remember, liberal democracy basically destroys your capacity to tell between friend and enemy. So the quote-unquote advisor comes, you know, is just a bloke in a suit or a woman in a pantsuit. She comes as a friend, or he comes as a friend. But actually, they're advising you to organize the country in a way that helps the Americans asset strip it. and destroy it for its own benefit, basically, which is what it did to all of Europe and what it's done to many other places. This is how the American Empire functions. Other empires in history function by building bridges and infrastructure and having an extractive relationship with their colonies. America is much more insidious because it destroys it from the inside out and basically holds a funnel over the mouth of the country and just pours poison down it, which is sweet tasting poison. It just slows you, it slowly kills you. That's the American way of doing it. So in a way, the least honest way of operating an empire ever. I have nothing but contempt for the American empire because it is, to me, an anti-civilization, an anti-empire, an anti-culture. And it basically just destroys everywhere it goes in from the inside out. Whereas empires in the past, they may have been exploitative and, you know, they may have had their bad points, but what they didn't do is destroy a place from the inside and out. Just like a fundamental attack on the identity of the people, like a corrosive acid. So I have no respect for people who defend the American empire, because it's an empire of evil, an empire of lies. And when it falls, the entire world will cheer. All right, let me continue. Travis Veneer says, will you make an academic agency course on literary analysis and theory? Well, I've got the Foundations of Shakespeare coming out, and there's a lot of literary analysis and a little bit of theory in there. So yes, that should be coming out. Well, it will definitely be ready by the end of January, because that's when the book contract is due in. So Fulgrim says, wild that the Starmer and the Blob are dredging up BNP-esque talking points to own the Tories. Hopefully their Cersei Lannister moment of arming the faith militant that bites them later on. Well, what's happened when it comes to the Tories? What happens when it comes to the Tories and Labour, and what's happening there, is that the long talked about Tony Blair play that I talked about for the past 2 years and I talked about before the election, seemingly Starmer's just started listening to Blair again. I don't know when exactly it happened, but it was basically night and day. It was like Starmer woke up one day, he had new instructions, he'd fired Sue Gray. It'd be like, right, okay, tone is back because I am the least popular prime minister of all time. It's dire straits here. How are we going to get it back? All right, we're going to finally listen to tone. Tone is back. They're doing the Blair plays as they should have done from the start, really. Blair's come in. He's been like, right, you didn't listen to me, did you? Come on, Keir, admit it. You didn't admit, and now you're in the ship. You're going to listen to me this time? Yes, tone, okay. And you can already see things are going Blair's way again. Digital ID is back. They're introducing digital ID in pubs and clubs and things now, and casinos and various other places. They're sneaking in the digital ID. So he's getting his foot in there. And it's just really obvious that the Blairites are back in the room after Starmer. I mean, I think he had like a couple of months where he thought, right, I'm the prime minister now. I can go this alone. I know what I'm doing. Bugger off, Blairites. Well, that was a disaster. And it's clear that somebody has taken Starmer aside and been like, no, we're going to do it this way. And frankly, he's the Dark Lord for a reason, right? This strategy works. They are absolutely wrecking the Tories. Every time Kemi Badenoch stands up in PMQs, Starmer just drills and destroys her on immigration. And they're pulling up clips of Kemi Badenoch supporting it. They're calling it a radical open borders experiment. They are hammering the Tories. Now, I think for reform should be making hay with this and be getting emboldened. Farage keeps on saying the momentum is with them. I believe this is media puffery, basically, and that reform are weak, pathetic, not making the most of it, dropping the ball. I continue to believe that that is the case. And if things carry on, we could end up with a very strange scenario where there's no overall majority, because even though these plays of the Dark Lord work, the damage Starmer did over Southport and the damage he's already done, it may be too late for him. Frankly, I think the Labour could reduce immigration to zero, and I still don't think most people would vote for them, because they just hate Starmer as a man, as a person. I hate Starmer as a person and a man. It's been amazing watching him doing this, and we've all been like fist bumping watching the Terminator work for us for a change, right? But I don't think that most people are going to fall for it. Basically, they're not going to go for it, because it's very hard to turn around first impressions. And the first impression that the country had of Starmer was that Keir Starmer is inhuman and he hates this country. And I reckon he could turn all the boats around and reduce immigration to zero, and still, I don't think he's going to get much for it. But Farage is not really grabbing the issue by the scruff of the neck. The Tories are done and dusted. Fucking Lib Dems are still like going to theme parks and doing Christmas dances and all this nonsense. So it's very possible that we could be in a hung parliament sort of situation if they hold an election, if nothing changes. I don't know how much longer the Kemi Badenoch can take the... she is getting caned. She is getting absolutely destroyed every time. And the fact that she is Nigerian, right? The fact that she is quite clearly an immigrant herself, when Labour are going hard anti-immigration, is backfiring pretty heavily on the Tories, as somebody thought about. So from my perspective, from the zero seats perspective, things are playing out great. Because, the Tory are getting double tapped. Remember, I campaigned on this channel for Kemi Badenoch to be the leader, because I didn't want T1000 to reform. Well, T1000 is currently dangling over the lava. Hasta la vista, baby. So there we are. Art Dinoism says, what is the status of the phenomenon of astroturfing in relation to elite theory? Is it a failure of an elite to spread their ideology? Does it ultimately matter if an elite astroturf something, but they are the organized minority? Well, I mean, the easiest way to put it is this, right? Think about Vladimir Putin's regime in Russia. That is Putinite, right? I.e., Putin is not going to allow anyone who is anti-Putin to be part of his system, okay? Or, I don't know, communist Soviet Union, even easier. So in the Soviet Union, you're not allowed to not be a communist and be part, like, you have to be part of the party to be part of the regime. So astroturfing is basically the regime ensuring that all of the operatives within a system are part of itself. What is it? It's liberal. It's a liberal democracy. So your choice is between Liberal Democrat 1, Liberal Democrat 2, Liberal Democrat 3. You can have the Gordon Brown, you can have the David Cameron, or you can have the Nick Clegg. I agree with Nick. That's where the system always wants to get back to. And whether now they've got a problem, because Trump, of course, seems like he's not one of those, okay? But of course, Trump is only one man. So they can surround him with a bunch of cringe lords and people like James Lindsay, right? And Konstantin Kissin and Jordan Peterson and blah, blah, blah. And essentially, you can get back there. You can essentially just get back there and they'll give you just a different flavor of Liberal Democrat. They're not going to offer you not a Liberal Democrat. So they'll water it down and water it down and water it. So you start with Trump saying they're not sending their best. America first. And you end up with actually Israel first. And actually, we're just 90s liberals now. Actually, we're just going to water it down so that you're just Mitt Romney again. That's basically what it's like, Mitt Romney with tough talk on immigration. Not even that, tough talk on illegal immigration. That's basically what it does. That's the purpose of astroturfing. So it kind of works to nullify any true resistance to itself. And you can always tell when the regime is unsuccessful at doing this, when somebody slips through, because they have to destroy them. They tried to destroy Trump many times. But a better example would be Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn took hold of the Labour Party. The system didn't like that, and it utterly destroyed him and ensured that Keir Starmer was put in place and ensured that all of the people who were loyal to Corbyn, which represents not a Liberal Democrat, basically, something else, was destroyed. And you could argue that some of those people who were in the Labour Party who survived the purge were actually put in there as insurance policies, astroturfs, if you want. David Lammy, for example, was never a commie momentum guy. He was always a regime man. Starmer was a regime man, stuck in there. Corbyn couldn't get rid of him, or he was pretending or whatever. But ultimately, Starmer's a regime man. So this is what the purpose of it is. Hopefully you understand this. Mrs. A's anti-Welsh racism says, she even gave me, what did she give me the other day? Go on, get back down the mines. She always loves that line. A couple of thoughts on the intellectual authors on your list. So this is on the 10 left-wing books James Lindsay should read. A couple of thoughts on the intellectual authors on your list. I.e. not Lenin and Mao, right? So all of the guys who weren't actually leaders. One theme across these books is to deconstruct politics, society, and culture. Their ideas have been used by the regime to dissolve traditional society. Many of them would either consider this progress or has given cover. However, indirectly, for the regime to concentrate, to concrete over the village green. Yeah, absolutely. They've been used to tear down what people hold dear, even if they acknowledge that people do hold it so. Yes, I agree. Two, is not one of the lessons of these books that there is the friend-enemy distinction? Aren't they enemies? Because of one, why should we give these leftists the light of day? What do they say that Carlyle, Evola, Bowden and others don't? Didn't the Frankfurt School at one point control the CIA, denazify Germany, and sponsor things like the Race Relations Board in Britain? Why can't we focus on building our own power and use our intellectuals to justify it? Well, the answer to that question is, until you understand the mechanisms of what they did, why they did it, why they worked, how they did it, how are you going to counter it if you don't know what they did? And in order to understand what they did, you have to understand what they wrote and what they thought they were doing. Hence, there are things to learn from these people. I mean, it's funny, you mentioned Carlyle. All the Marxists read Carlyle. Every Marxist read Carlyle and internalized Carlyle, including Marx, including Engels. So they didn't follow that rule, even though Carlyle was an evil reactionary and all the rest of it. They still all read him and understood what he was saying. So I still think there are things to learn from leftists. there's basically nothing to learn from James Lindsay or from Jordan Peterson or from Ben Shapiro. Like, there's nothing you can learn from them at all. Zero. Zero. Why? Because those people are there as containment. Those people are there for a purpose. What is their purpose? To keep you liberal, to keep you part of the system, to keep you from fighting the system, to keep you in the status quo as it exists. Their role is to defend this system. All of those people, when they did their writings, were actually writing from outside the system. Most of them. Frankfurt School, you could say, well, they had CIA backing and they were safe in New York, etc. But they were, let's be fair to them, coming from a regime, the Nazi German regime, that would have killed them had they not fled, or could have killed them or arrested them. At the very least, they would have arrested them, right? So I say these people are worth listening to, much more than any center-right thinker. That's my view. You may disagree. Alphonse Rides Again says, I didn't realize Mao had raged against liberals. Does Chinese society ever produce liberals? Well, I mean, Micro-Imperium Press argues that Taoism is the liberalism of China, or that there's a flavor of liberalism in Taoism. And that combat liberalism, it's only like a 2-3 page essay by Mao, combat liberalism, is well worth a listen to see what he thinks of and how he thought of what liberalism was, and how the liberal in yourself is always like a danger to being politically effective. Because what liberalism is ultimately is the desire to escape politics. It's the desire to escape politics. It's that impetus in you that just wants to grill. Go back to your room. Play with your toys and your costumes. Forget about the baby. Such a pity. Lamented Guide says, turn back, Sarah. Turn back before it's too late. You have 13 hours in which to solve the labyrinth before your baby brother becomes one of us forever. Lamented Guide said, this was fascinating to come back to now with the Trump re-election. Only time will tell. If Trump will in, so this was a comment on a long, an old video called What Can Carl Schmitt Teach Tim Pool? What Can Carl Schmitt Teach Tim Pool? Seems that Tim Pool has learnt a bit of Carl Schmitt since I made that video. Well, anyway, Lamented Guide says, this was fascinating to come back to now that Trump has been re-elected. The only time will tell if Trump will invert the enemy distinction that Biden set up. Yeah, I suspect he won't. I suspect that nobody will go to Gitmo or get into trouble. I suspect that anybody who's on like the Q train expecting to see like real comeuppance for regime big names is going to be sorely disappointed. Nothing ever happens when it comes to those sorts of things. You may get a couple of kind of small fry scalps or something, but I will be shocked if somebody at the Obama or Biden or Hillary Clinton level, or even at like the CIA director or FBI director level, I just don't see that happening. And let's face it, Trump's number one concern is not going after his enemies. It's he's got other concerns. Really, his donors, essentially. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more. Larry Lyman says, or Larry Lifeman says, this was on 10 left-wing books that James Lindsay should read. $50, ladies and gentlemen. 50 Australian dollars. Well, thank you very much for that, sir. I shall take that 50 Australian dollars and I shall buy a multi-pack of Quavers or Skips. What's a good, like, what could I buy with 50 Australian dollars? Maybe people can suggest what I can spend 50 whole Australian dollars on. Multi-pack of Quavers, I say. Tin of Quality Street. What do you reckon, folks? If it is true that all wars have an element of ethnic conflict underpinning them, then is the culture war that is being waged by progressives across the globe really just a war between whites and other traditional races and the new superior grey religion of ethnically homogenized urban leftists? Is the telos of globalization ultimately the mass ethnic cleansing of old world races and the assertion of the supremacy of the new greys? Well, I do think there's an ethnic component to what the new ideology is trying to do. But I'm afraid here on YouTube, it may be tricky to go into the details. Understand what I'm saying, Harry? You understand what I'm saying? There is an ethnic component, without doubt. But I am skeptical as to the extent to which it is equally against all races in that way. I mean, I do agree that if the global American empire gets hold of your country, it will turn it into a pale Disneyland shadow of its former self. So it will take Mexico and it will turn it into Taco Bell. It will take, I mean, look at Syria now. Okay, I mean, it's under these jihadis currently. But let's pretend that America had its wicked way with Syria. It would turn Syria basically into a kind of kebab-themed restaurant. Kebab-themed fast food restaurant, you know. Arabian Nights, Disneyland, there's the Arabian Nights bit. It would turn Syria into that, basically. Maybe with a genie and fucking Aladdin there as well. So on that set, in that way, yes, it's equally against everybody. But I think there are very particular animosities against European whites in particular, and Northern European Nordics in particular, if you want to get even more. Anyway, I'm talking like Scandis, Blondes, Germans, Anglo-Saxons. It has particular hatreds of those. Why, you might ask? Well, that's a topic for a different day and possibly a different platform, folks. All right, let's carry on. Mobe7 says, "Hi, AA. You mentioned that you had previously given some lectures on Louis Althusser. Are these available to view online? If not, it would be of great interest to see you present them again." I don't know if I still have a copy of that old lecture I used to give. I could probably recreate it, to be honest. No, it does not exist online. It's one I gave in person many, 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 many times. Maybe I'll give that after the lecture again. You have to remind me, because it's an extremely busy time of year for me at the moment. Alphonse Rides Again has given a £2 super thanks on the original Andrew Marvell Deepest Law for the Marvell stream. That is a very old in joke. Int Boom says, "Thank you for this one." So this was on the 10 left-wing books James Lindsay should read. He says, "Thank you for this one about James Lindsay. There's something to be said for his attempts to prove a connection between wokeness and socialism in the days when people claimed intersectionality had no cultural impact on any institutions. but he's clearly burnt out on it all now. Closest thing to an existing quote-unquote woke right was probably Richard Spencer, given that he pretty explicitly wanted to take the progressive stack and put American whites on top of it. Well, I mean, not only that, to give the devil his due, old Dickie has always seen himself in an American mainline of progressivism, from Woodrow Wilson and even people like Theodore Roosevelt and, you know, the original eugenicists of the early 20th century. Like, that was kind of Dickie's intellectual, you know, like people like Madison Grant and Stoddard, right? They were not conservatives. They were progressives in the truest, bluest-eyed, kind of almost insane, you know, to infinity and beyond, you know, we shall stand astride the world and achieve greatness together using science. This has always been part of his thing, really. I mean, his position is a bit more complicated now, I would say, but that's kind of where he is. The irony is, of course, is that old, you know, neckbeard James Lindsay actually probably has quite a bit of that style of progressivism in his thinking, doesn't he? I mean, he's one step away from being kind of a Reddit tier progressive, James Lindsay. So I just don't really see on what kind of position he would attack someone like Dickie Spence. I mean, if you ask me, Dickie Spence is a lot more intelligent than James Lindsay. So he has a kind of absolute advantage in that score. I mean, I genuinely believe that James Lindsay is thick. Right? He could have a PhD in maths and he could have, you know, I just think he's thick. He's stupid. And I've seen literally no counter evidence to that whatsoever. And the quality of his supporters is low as well. And the quality of his tweets is low. And the quality of his writing is poor. And I teach a writing course here, Foundations of Writing. And, you know, every once in a while, I see somebody try to have a go at my writing. And this is a little bit like somebody like having a go at professional footballer for their technique or something. You're watching Lionel Messi and you're saying, oh, well, I don't like how he dribbled that ball there. Let me just tell you something. There's nothing that any of those people who've tried to have a go at my writing could teach me about writing whatsoever. And I can tell you that for a fact. But there are some people who can't write for toffee. Jordan Peterson is one of them. I have done streams before going through Peterson's atrocious prose and making it better, making it more legible. Now, I have read some of James Lindsay's writing, and he too has atrocious prose, like wordy, verbose, you know, nonsensical at times, because he's trying to give the impression that he's clever. He's trying to bamboozle. And, you know, I'll just give you a few free writing lessons. Don't use the long word. Use the short one. Use the plainest word you can possibly find in everyday English. Try to write so that almost a child could understand what you're saying. Don't try to bamboozle with your big words. James is a midwit, I'm afraid. Not even a midwit, lower than that. I would be surprised if he took an IQ test and got into triple digits. I really would. He's thick. Whereas Dickie Spencer, okay, he's made a few mistakes in life, but he's a clever guy. I can tell. Now, it just so happens that Lindsay finished his PhD and Spencer, I think, dropped out of his. But that's not a measure of intelligence. Whether you finish your PhD or not is not the measure of whether you've got, you know, it's like you could still fit, you know, in the D&D stats, you could have a int 10, right, or int 11, and still pass a PhD. Or you could still do a PhD and get through the Viva, grind it out. Whereas you could easily get someone who's an 18 int who fails their PhD. Now, obviously, I passed mine, but that's by the by. I'm just trying to make the point that the qualification doesn't tell you anything. Anyway, where was I? Hello, G says, I have grown frustrated with the... Right, so this is on the video from earlier today. 20 euros. Woo! What can I do with 20 euros? 10 packs of pork scratchings. Four multi-packs of Mr. Porky's pork scratchings. What do you reckon? What do you think, folks? Anyway, I'm very grateful for the euros, friend. He says, so this was on the Fall of Assad video from earlier today. He says, I have grown frustrated with the cope-laden, one-sided takes from the Judge Knapp crew, the Duran, and similar outlets. If the narratives we endorse are losing, I want to confront and come to terms with that reality before the battle is already over. Cope presented as truth should no longer be tolerated, and we must demand improvement. Yeah, I agree. And where those guys are coping, I think they should be called out. One person who's been quite big on this point has been my Canadian buddy, the Black Horse, who has caught cope from that crew on a number of occasions and then come back to it a week after or 2 weeks after and be like, what about that point they made there? Or what about, oh, they moved that past that. And I kept a particular eye on them this week, especially Scott Ritter, who 3 days before was saying, oh, there, the Lion of Damascus will be back and it's just going to be a rerun of last year. And then it flipped. And then his line was, well, nobody saw this coming. Nobody saw this coming. But that is not actually the line, because if you have a look at the post-fall narrative, the line coming from the Kremlin and the line coming from Tehran is, actually, we did know this was coming. We tried to warn him. We tried to give training and he rebuffed it. He's been turning that way for a while. Actually, if you knew what was going on, it wasn't that much of a surprise. So what changed in the 3 days between nobody knowing this was coming and now everybody being on this new page? This is something that if I was Judge Knapp, I would say, Scott, my dear friend, 3 days ago you told me this. How come the line has changed now? And like, you know, Judge Knapp asked the same question to every guest. I'd go in with that on every guest. Be like I'm not being hostile. Like, we're still buddies, my dear friend, right? I still want you back every week. But you got to come clean here. Like, what were you slinging a week ago? Like, did you have false intelligence back then, or were you just making it up, or like, have you just been given new lines to say now? Like, what's the deal? And this is why I think it's important to have truly independent voices in the space like me. I'm truly independent. I take no money from anybody. I'm just a bloke. Just a bloke sitting with my own laptop in my own house, talking, trying to make sense of things. Just like anybody else, just a bloke, right? It's important to have those people who you can say, well, look, whatever the truth is, he's gonna tell me, okay? And frankly, I think that there's some explaining to do from that neck of the woods, okay? I will note that Mercuris and the Duran were onto the post-Assad narrative way quicker than anybody else. In fact, they were there before it even happened. They were, I can always tell when Mercurius is telegraphing, and he was down on Assad. He was not hopeful, and he was not kind of giving the Scott Ritter, Putin's going to come in again. He didn't. You can go back and watch him a week or 2 weeks ago. So Mercurius knew something was up. Shrewd. So I note these things. I just note these things. Okay. And I still watch Judge Knapp and Duran. They're still my go-to guys for Geopol. But you have to, with certain people, with Ritter, I often skip Ritter, I'll be honest. But on big stories like this, I be like, well, what's Ritter saying? There's something up. There's definitely something up there, whatever that happens to be. Now, does that mean that because those guys may embellish things or get things wrong sometimes, you should therefore go running back to mainstream media and, NAFO and, all of a sudden what Washington's saying is true? No. If there's one thing you know for certain is that the regime is always lying about something, right? They're always lying about something. Even with this Syria situation, what have they lied about? Okay. Joe Biden claimed credit for it. And they had this Jalani Jihadi guy, right? They had him on CNN, didn't they? What do they lie about? They lied, like they said, oh, well, he's reformed now. He's no longer like radical Islamic, or he's a moderate. He's going to embrace diversity and inclusion and all this sort of stuff. Come on. I mean, utter bollocks. They lie. They lie about everything, the regime. Even when they're ostensibly like winning, like in a situation like Syria, they still tell lots of lies along the way. So the regime and MSM are always unreliable. That said, if you use the tools that I have tried to teach you on this channel to read MSM, to read the mainstream media, they usually actually do tell you the real story. If you know how to pass out the noise, pass out the lies, there's often a signal, right? On this one, as I said in my video earlier on, I actually don't believe that Washington was expecting regime change to happen in a week. I really don't think they were expecting it. I think everybody was caught a little bit on the hop. And Scott Ritter is right about that, that everybody was kind of, whoa, nobody saw it coming. Okay, I agree with that. I'm just saying that some of his takes like a week beforehand look pretty bad a week after. Okay, and you have to take note of that. Me, I've retired from making predictions, so I'm out of that game. all right. What else? That was the last of the super thanks. Let us hit the super chats, if there are any. And there are some. Tim Cornish says, getting used to new cadence, just dropping by in to say nice working and tell you to get out. Well, thank you very much, Tim Cornish. You get out. Third man says, hard not to feel despair at the moment. It feels like things will only ever get worse here in England. Mass immigration continues and Islam is growing. Never over, third man. This sceptred isle has stood here for 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 3,000 years. It's never over. Never over. 700 years the Spanish were there under Arab rule and they came back. Told you before, the Persians conquered 4 times in history. 4 times they came back. Even against the evil American Empire, they still overthrew the puppet Shah and came back. Because a great people can never be kept down. And the British, the English, are such a people. one of the civilizational greats. Never forget it. They're all going to go back, don't worry. It is going to get sorted out. One way or the other. So do not give up. Kony says, Turkey has always had it out for the Assads. When Bashir's father supported Kurdish militant separatists in Kurdish populated Turkey. Yes, the Turks have never liked the Assads. Why? Because the Assads were Shia and sided with the Iranian influence in the region. And the Turks, if you see Shia Islam as a proxy for Iranian power, the Turks have their own flavor of Islam that is a proxy for Turkish power. The Muslim Brotherhood, or whatever they call it, it's their brand of Sunniism. So, of course, Turkey are not going to be happy with a Shia-friendly regime in Syria. It's right on their doorstep. Persia is the old rival to Turkey. Got to watch those Persians if you're a Turk. They give you the runaround, but really quite quickly and easily too, because the Persians are cleverer than the Turks. Way cleverer. But the Turks are good at other things. They're more pragmatic in a way, less theory cell than the Persian. The Turk is more pragmatic. Turk can be more ruthless as well, more ruthless. So, you know, and I think Erdogan's played it well. I mean, let's give it to him. He's played a blinder here, took the world by shock. I think he even took Washington by shock. This was an Erdogan play, let's face it. Maximus Aquilus says, is your dad a fan of the band The Clash? No, I don't think so. My dad was not really into music that much. And the music that he was into was cheesy. I remember he had one cassette tape and it was Lionel Richie's Can't Slow Down. I listened to that tape many times when I was a kid, but like he wasn't into music, my dad. He was like a kind of, in the 70s, he was like a Flares disco guy. Gold medallion, big hair, shades, the Flares, the lot. He was a 70s disco kid, my dad. Not Clash. Well, my friends, the time has come. Maximus Aquilus says, AKS99 says, books on the influence of a certain people. Well, car manufacturer, McDonald, make those two your starting points. I would always start with a car manufacturer. Start there. Then, you know, if it interests you, carry on. If it doesn't, don't. That question is not the be-all and end-all, and I've said that many times. Once you figure out some basic things, it actually becomes quite tiresome because it's always the same thing. The special carve-out, the Schmittian exception, it's kind of petty in a way. And I don't think it explains the totality of what we call the regime. It's one aspect of it. That's something I've always been pretty consistent on too. Chris Primer says, you can't hide from me, Paul Wolfowitz. Cringewalker says, there's a scene in Galaxy Quest where the general goes to explain, as you would to a child, and it perfectly encapsulates engaging with James Lindsay. I've been shocked by I always knew he was a bit of an idiot, but he is just weak, isn't he? He is thick. Chris Primer just says, take my money. Well, thank you very much, Chris Primer. Now, folks, we're just over an hour in, and I have to... Martin Greer has come in with a late super chat saying, there's a demo out for another roguelike card, a roguelike deck builder called Commander Quest. A bit cartoony, but some quick fun. Well, I will check that out. Add it to the list of ones I'm trying. If you want the list of ones I bought recently, I'll give it to you quickly. If you want a video, you'll have to tell me in the comments later. Knock on the Coffin Lid, Slice and Dice, Backpack Battles. I mean, that's a good one too. I picked that up and sunk 6 hours into it, like straight off, stayed up all night almost. Luck Be a Landlord, another banger. Slay the Spire, which is the granddaddy. Cross the Obelisk, which is deep, deep. It's good. Tainted Grail, which I only played for like 5 minutes. Dysomancer, which did not click with me, although I only gave it 5 minutes. Chrono Arc, which I haven't tried yet. Dungeons and Degenerate Gamblers, I haven't tried that yet. Wild Frost, which I haven't played yet. Inscription, which is a banger and a classic. And Balatro, which may just be the number one game on that list. However, before you buy it now, you should buy one of my courses at the academic agency and do that. Because if you buy Balatro, that will just eat up all of your life. And it won't make you any smarter like my courses will. It will just kind of give you fun. Well, my courses aren't fun, but they may make you write or think, you know, more effectively. All right. I have to go and pick up the little one now, folks. Thanks for joining me on this little goblin raid. And I'll see you next week. Don't forget to watch my Friday video. You know, every week I make a video on Friday and it's a little bit outside of my usual thing. It's my culture video. And every week, nobody watches my Friday video. And every week I think, oh, why didn't nobody watch my Friday video? If only you'd be men of culture as well as men of politics. But anyway, tomorrow I've got a fun one because I'm looking at the TV tropes of all of the different villains. Last week I did the TV teams and the movie teams. Tomorrow I'm looking at all the different types of villains. Please give it a watch. I tell you what, I might cancel the Friday video if people just don't watch them anymore. I'll have a look. I'll see if I can justify the time. Anyway, speaking of the time, I haven't got any left. Bye, everyone.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.